French philosopher René Descartes famously wrote, "I think, therefore I am." He meant the very act of thinking proves we exist, that we possess something called a self. But what if you're convinced you don't exist at all, or that you're dead? That's a rare but real mental condition called Cotard syndrome. Our next guest, Anil Ananthaswamy, is a science writer who spent years researching people who suffer from disorders that distort the sense of self. They range from well-known conditions, such as Alzheimer's and schizophrenia, to people who sense doppelgangers following them around, or become convinced an arm or a leg doesn't belong to them. What causes these conditions? Where does the self reside? Anil Ananthaswamy, at the intersection of neuroscience and philosophy, on Midday After the News. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. We've all heard of autism, a neurological condition that makes it difficult or impossible for children and adults to communicate and interact normally with others. Likewise, Alzheimer's, which robs its mostly elderly victims of their memories and ultimately their lives. We've all heard of schizophrenia, whose victims inhabit an altered reality that may include hallucinations, delusions, and bizarre behavior. All these conditions interfere with the victim's sense of self. But our next guest has spent years looking at strange disorders that aren't as well known, but also interfere with that intersection of neurology, psychology, and philosophy known as the self. In a fascinating book called The Man Who Wasn't There, science writer Anil Ananthaswamy describes a man called David who suffered from body integrity disorder. He was so convinced that one of his legs did not belong to him that he traveled to Asia for an off-the-books amputation that ultimately relieved his mental distress. Another man suffered from Cotard's syndrome, a belief that he was truly dead and no longer existed. Other victims may believe their body parts are putrefying, or that they've lost internal organs. Anil Ananthaswamy studied subjects who suffer from otoscopic phenomena and believe they're being shadowed by lookalikes, or that they're watching their own bodies from the outside. There's also the case of ecstatic epilepsy, a type of seizure that makes the victim feel an epiphany, a sense of deeper reality, or a feeling of transcendental joy. All of these conditions indicate that there's something wrong with the way the victims perceive who they are, their sense of self, a subject that philosophers and more recently scientists have long debated. Anil Ananthaswamy interviewed neuroscientists, psychiatrists, and other researchers in an effort to pinpoint the source of the self and the root of these disorders. What he found may surprise you. Anil Ananthaswamy is a freelance writer whose award-winning work concentrates on the cutting edge of scientific research. A former news editor and current consultant for New Scientist magazine, he's written for many scientific and national news outlets. He's a guest editor in the Science Writing Program at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and he teaches science writing at the National Center for Biological Sciences in India. His first book was The Edge of Physics. It was voted Book of the Year in 2010 by Physics World. And the latest book, again, is The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. It's published, available from Dutton Books. Nice to have you on the show, Anil. Thank you for joining us here on Midday.
Thank you, Dan. It's my pleasure to be on your show.
I just mentioned the title of your previous book, which gets me to the first question. The Edge of Physics, you're exploring the boundaries of physics, which by definition involves, you know, the fundamental nature of the physical universe. And so here we sort of step into the realm of the metaphysical, don't we? So I wonder what got you to the study of the self.
Even in the physics book, the book was bookended by visits to a couple of monasteries. So the opening chapter, I kind of have a little description of a Christian monastery here in California, and the epilogue ends with a description of a Buddhist monastery. And I was fascinated by that juxtaposition as a metaphor that, you know, you have astronomers, cosmologists looking outwards in you know, and they're all on mountaintops and very extreme places, looking outwards in places of, you know, extreme silence. They need silence for their instruments, radio silence, silence from light pollution, etc. And then you have monks in similar places who are there for a very ostensibly different reason. They're looking inward. But for me, the metaphor was kind of, you know, telling me that they're all sort of doing the same thing. They're trying to understand who we are, why we are here, where we're going, just different ways and different ways of knowing about, you know, this thing called existence. So in some sense for me, this is not terribly different. It's just a continuation of a curiosity. You know, my interest in the self probably goes back to my 20s and must have something to do with the fact that I grew up in India where the religions are very, very concerned about the nature of the self.
This is not just a sideshow at the science fair. Your theory is that we can understand the nature of the self by looking at mental conditions that somehow interfere with the normal mechanisms that make us who we are. Is that it?
I think that's, very accurately put. I think if you look at neuroscience over the last few decades, what we have learned about the brain, for instance, the functioning of the brain, a lot of what we have learned has come from studying people who have had unfortunate injuries, trauma, strokes, you know, and have lost some part of their brain anatomy and hence have lost some functionality. And by correlating, you know, those, you know, functional losses with the actual damage to the tissue, we've understood how, you know, a lot of the brain functions. And there are other ways of studying the brain, of course, but this has been very instrumental. And in some sense, I thought that one way to understand the self, which, you know, for each one of us, we're all, you know, each one of us is a self. There's no denying that. But it kind of feels very solid to us. We don't ever kind of think that, okay, there might be processes in the brain that are trying to make this feeling happen. And so by looking at conditions where some aspect of our otherwise solid self seems to get perturbed, I figured there was a way in to, you know, that you could potentially sort of separate out the strands that make up the self.
Well, thank you for that. I want to go right to Alzheimer's then, because I have this question I've been wanting to ask you. We all know, many of us know people who have suffered from this disease now.
Unfortunately, a lot of us do.
And we've seen how it affects its victims. And I wonder about the self in there. You know, when we look at somebody who is suffering from this disease at its advanced stage. So here's my question, Anil. Once Alzheimer's has sort of run its course and the patient can't remember anything, I mean, do you think that there's still some part of the self there?
It's really a very, very deep question, because the quick answer to that is we don't know. And the long answer, I think it's worth getting into, is that, you know, what Alzheimer's does is, as you had indicated earlier, it starts by chipping away at our memories. And to begin with, it stops new memories from forming. And when you think of who we are, at some basic level, when you ask someone, who are you, you're going to get kind of a narrative answer to, you know, to that question. They're going to tell you about, you know, where they were born, where they grew up, what they do, etc. And these are all based on memories of episodes in their life. Somehow this story is built up and kept as a coherent narrative in our heads. And this is how we see ourselves. This is how we explain ourselves to others. But in order for this narrative to keep growing, obviously you need memories to keep forming. And Alzheimer's, the first thing it really does is kind of stops that narrative from forming. So you can think of this aspect of ourselves as the narrative self or the autobiographical self, something that you do, you can consciously recall and talk about. And that part of the self starts getting affected very quickly in Alzheimer's. It's, you know, to begin with, it stops forming, and then Alzheimer's actually starts eating away at existing memories and scrambles your narrative. So something, what's happening really in the mid to late stages is, you know, your narrative is disappearing, and other cognitive abilities are also going away. It's very clear that this aspect of the self is definitely getting destroyed. Now, the bigger question that's not clear is, you know, once the narrative is gone, once someone has lost the ability to interact with others and to be able to tell their story, does it mean that there is no one in there that feels, for instance, pain or hunger as their own, even though they have no story on top of that? And the answer to that is we don't know. And really, that gets to the heart of questions about the self, like how is the self built up in the brain? Is it just the narrative? There are philosophers who have argued that all we are these narratives, that you take away the narratives and there is nothing in there. And if you talk to caregivers and people who, you know, look after patients with Alzheimer's, some of the responses you will get are phrases to that effect. They'll say, oh, I don't see anyone in there. The person I knew is gone. And that's an assessment from the outside. We're looking at someone. We're trying to interact with someone who has, you know, end-stage Alzheimer's, and we're getting nothing in terms of behavioral interaction. So our cognitive perception of what's happening is from the outside, oh, there is no one in there. But we really don't know. And that is where, you know, Alzheimer's doesn't tell us anything more because, unfortunately, like you said, you know, the person is suffering so much and is completely unable to tell us what might be the situation.
Hmm. We're at that intersection of neuroscience and philosophy. So I'll ask this question. What do you think Rene Descartes would make of Alzheimer's? What might the philosopher and mathematician say about that?
I mean, I think, you know, Descartes has been kind of, neuroscience has moved away from Descartes' position, so I would imagine.
Oh, I think, therefore, I am?
Yeah, very much so. I think, you know, Descartes clearly separated the mind from the body. There was a very clear dualism in Descartes' thinking, and we have moved away from that dualism, both in philosophy and in neuroscience. It's very clear that, you know, the mind is not some separate thing from the body. It is very, very, there's a very, very close interaction between, you know, what's happening in the mind and what the body does. And so Descartes, you know, brilliant man that he was, would absolutely revisit his, you know, ideas, I'm sure.
By studying some of these disorders that may not be very familiar to our listeners here, mm-hmm. You hope to understand more about the self. So my question is, of all the conditions you studied, and some that I mentioned in the introduction, Neil, which did you find the most surprising when you got in there?
I think the most surprising or the most philosophically challenging is the one you mentioned called Cotard syndrome.
Cotard's.
You know, and which really does kind of challenge our notions of what it means to say I exist or I think, therefore I am. You know, Cotard syndrome is a syndrome that was named after the French psychologist who identified the symptoms. His name was Jules Cotard, and this was done in the late 1800s. And it's a constellation of symptoms. One, you know, people will say that they feel like some part of their body is missing. They're missing their stomach or uterus or teeth or you know, things like that. And they also have other delusions. And the biggest, most striking symptom of Cotard's is this assertion from the patient that he or she does not exist or he or she is dead. And you can imagine that really does raise a whole lot of philosophical questions about what does that mean? It's kind of a logical impossibility to think about a person who very obviously exist, objectively speaking. We can mm-hmm. look at them from the outside. They're eating, sleeping, drinking, doing all the things that we do in, you know, when we exist. And yet there is this complete conviction that they don't exist. So it is a very challenging and very intriguing phenomenon.
Do people who have Cotard syndrome, are they able to function? Is this a disabling syndrome?
So it can be disabling in the sense that a lot of times the person with Cotard's is extremely depressed. So I had met a few psychiatrists, mainly in France, and there was a psychiatrist in Paris who kind of explained, the level of depression that some people with Cotard's might experience. He drew me a line diagram on a piece of paper, with normal on the left side, and then at equal intervals in a linear progression, the different states that we might go through, normal, sad, melancholic, depressed, very depressed. And then he drew a series of dots. It's as if the progression was not linear anymore. And at the end of it, he put Cotard's, and he said sometimes people with Cotard's are very, very depressed. So in that sense, they may not be functional, but they can also be. I mean, I write about one patient who was functional enough to be, doing all the things that you and I would do. He was depressed, of course. But when his neurologist would have discussions with him about the logic of his assertions, he was claiming to be brain dead, and his neurologist would say, "Look, you're talking to me. We're having this conversation. Obviously, your mind is alive." And he would say, "Yes, my mind is alive, but the mind and brain are not sort of distinct." And he would say, "No, my mind is alive, but my brain is dead." And he would, there was some aspect of him that felt that he didn't exist. He would spend time in graveyards because he felt more akin to people who are already dead. Hmm. So, it doesn't make logical sense. And that's the whole point, is, trying to understand why this would be such a convincing delusion for someone experiencing it.
Is that the man who wasn't there, or an example?
Yeah, I mean, the title refers to a few different, possible situations. So Cotard's would be one. And I think in some sense, it also refers to this notion that a lot of aspects of the self that we think is solid and that make us the person that we think we are can also be argued to be something that the brain puts together moment by moment and can be, changed and disrupted, and it questions the solidity of that also, or the fact that we take that to be some sort of immutable thing.
We're going to take a break here. We'll come back and talk some more with Anil Athanaswamy, science writer, author of The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. It's a fascinating look at what makes us who we are, the sense of self that proves our existence and separates us from others. This is The Midday Show. Dan Roderick's. We welcome calls during this hour of the show if you have questions about anything you hear as Anil joins us for conversation. The phone number is 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. Midday's email address, midday@wypr.org. Science journalist Anil Athanaswamy, our guest in this hour of Midday, is taking a look at the latest scientific research and cases of people with neuropsychological conditions ranging from autism and schizophrenia to little-known disorders ranging from, we just mentioned one, Cotard's syndrome, Anil described, which convinces victims they don't exist. And then there's the doppelganger effect, where people see and interact with duplicates of themselves. So we'll talk some more about this. Why don't we go right to that one, since I just mentioned it, Anil, this idea that, there's a duplicate of you or me, and it's following us around. We can see it.
Yeah, the doppelganger effect comes under the sort of rubric of something called otoscopic phenomena, and people will probably more readily relate to this when we talk of something like out-of-body experiences. So a doppelganger effect is a kind of out-of-body experiences, though it's even more complicated. And like you said, what happens is that people will perceive another themselves in front of them, and sometimes they will actually interact with this double. And their sense of location, where they are, normally when you think about who we never again stop to think about this, but we are located in a volume of space that is occupied by the body. and we have a perspective. We seem to be looking out at the world from behind our eyes, from inside our heads, and that's the feeling we have, and that's the kind of in-body experience. And when you're having a doppelganger effect, the first thing that happens is you perceive another body or another you next to you, and then your sense of where you're located and your identification with that volume of space that is your physical body, that can change. You can suddenly find yourself in the virtual body, the duplicate, and looking at your physical body. And this can happen in rapid succession where you're alternating back and forth between the real physical body and the duplicate. It's very, very distressing for people who are experiencing it, as you can imagine.
Yes. It's a hallucination.
And it is a hallucination.
You know, we use the term hallucination, and before the break, you used the term delusion for a moment. Mm. I'm not sure I understand. I think we know it when we see it. If we had one, I guess we could say, I'm having a hallucination. Or you could say to someone, you're having an hallucination brought on by, you know, mind-altering substances that you shouldn't have consumed. But what do we mean by a hallucination exactly, if you don't mind that question?
I mean, you're perceiving something that is not real, that you're hallucinating. It's something that's definitely happening in your mind. There is no, you know, duplicate outside of your mind. There is no physical material thing that has been created outside of you. It's a product of something that is happening in your brain. But it's not real.
But the philosopher might say, oh, but it's real. No, if it's real to you, it's not an hallucination to you. It's part of your world
within
a world,
and,
right?
And I think that is exactly the point that we need to keep in mind when we talk of all these conditions, is that the subjective reality for the person experiencing it is extremely real, and hence their suffering is extremely real. So, you know, just like each one of us is a self that, you know, no one can tell you that, oh, you know, this is all made up by the brain. You know, philosophers have this term called the phenomenal self. The self as it feels to me is real. I mean, there's no denying that. And then any changes to that self, to that sense of what one is also real, because that's all we are at that moment in time.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. I think, you know, for the person at that moment experiencing the hallucination, that is their reality, and you have to accept that.
Now, you referred to otoscopic phenomena or the doppelganger effect, all part of this out-of-body experience you mentioned. It sounds like the doppelganger effect is a more complex or extreme example of out-of-body experience, but people report out-of-body experience. Just this morning I mentioned to a friend, you know, who asked me what the show was about today, and I described your book, The Man Who Wasn't There, and she said she had had out-of-body experience, very scary. I said, what was that like? She thought she was seeing her own body, that she could view herself from above. I think she said it was as if she were in the sky looking down on herself. Is that how others describe it? Is that similar?
Yeah, so that's the classic out-of-body experiences, and turns out it's pretty common. Like, you know, 5% of the population at some point in their lives would experience it, which is quite a large number when you think about it. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly, you know, the phenomenology or what it feels like to experience a classic out-of-body experience is exactly what your friend said, where you feel like you, whatever that you is, the I that perceives oneself, is outside the physical bodies. Usually it's from a vantage point that's near the ceiling or somewhere above the body looking down at the physical body. And that's, you know, when people report experiences of this kind, that's pretty much what it's like.
Does that take you into the realm of dreams at all? When you were doing research for the book, did you get into the realm of dreams?
I didn't actually do much research into dreams because I felt like at this point, dreams, we don't understand them well enough. And I was really looking for conditions that are being studied within science in a way that I can illuminate the nature of the self. So I stayed away from dreams. But, you know, my suspicion is that in some sense, out-of-body experiences and dreams, something about the way these things happen, they will turn out to have commonalities.
So curious about something, because some of the conditions that you describe Anila, pretty bizarre. And I wonder if you had trouble getting people to talk to you about that, or were they happy to share their experiences with their experiences?
I didn't have too much trouble talking with people. I think once you accept, like we were just discussing, once you accept the fact that whatever someone is experiencing is real and you are not judging them on that, you know, so and not thinking of it as something outlandish or something that shouldn't happen, because it is happening, and accepting the reality for what it is and just trying to understand it. And as soon as they would realize that that was my intention, to really get a sense for the subjective reality and understand it from their perspective, most of the people that I talked to were really willing. And, you know, maybe this is the point where I should say I'm really thankful to them, because, you know, we understand all these things because of people who are willing to come and, you know, tell us their stories.
Award-winning science writer Anil Anathswamy is our guest. His book is The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. And we welcome questions during this hour of midday. If you have one for our guest, please give us a call. 410-662-8780 is the phone number here in Maryland, in Baltimore. Toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. And we can take questions or comments by email, too, at midday@wypr.org. Anil, let's take a moment here and take a call. This is Wayne giving us a ring from Baltimore. Go right ahead, Wayne.
I'd like to ask what you think the role of language is in our possession of a sense of self. It seems obviously to have a role, you know, with what you've talked about as a sort of a narrative sense of the self. So would you say, for example, that a non-language-using animal, like a dog or maybe an orangutan or something like that, has a sense of self?
Yeah, and we don't even have to go, to animals to understand that even without language, we do have a sense of self. For instance, a newborn human baby, we will not dispute that you know, a baby has some notion of a self. Now, it's not the kind of narrative, autobiographical, cognitive sense of self that, say, even, you know, a four-year-old or anyone older than, you know, 4 years would have. But if you, for instance, take a baby that's absolutely newly born, the first 24 hours of its life, and touch its cheek, babies have something called a rooting reflex. They will turn towards the touch. But what's interesting is that babies also are constantly touching themselves, like they will accidentally touch their own cheek. And it turns out they will turn their heads to look at who's touching them, as long as it's not themselves. So they already have some implicit sense of their own body, that when they touch their own cheek, they're far less likely to turn their head than if the mother or father or someone else touched their cheek. So you can see here that, you know, that there is something there, that baby has some implicit sense of self versus non-self. Now, it's obviously not a cognitive social self. So to answer your, the first aspect of that question, language does play a role in creating a certain kind of self. So it's very clear it plays a role in our autobiographical narrative self. And so the notion that there is a social self, all of those things, yes, you know, language would be a big part of that. But even without language, we have ample evidence that there is a kind of self that is, you know, more basic than the narrative that exists.
This is really interesting. Anil, so I've got so much to ask you here in the time remaining. Let me take you to the one that another disorder that, or a condition that I mentioned in the outset, body integrity identity disorder, BIID,
right.
Or BID.
Right.
Now, many of us have heard about the phantom limb. In fact, I read a book this past year on earlier this year on World War One and World War One soldiers reporting phantom limbs after amputations, after having been wounded in war. So it seems like the flip side of the phantom limb is BIID, is body integrity identity. that you have a limb you shouldn't have.
Yeah, and I think maybe we can briefly talk about what phantom limbs are, because I think that really sets up a way to understand BIID. So phantom limbs are basically the feeling people have that they, you know, once they've had an amputation for some unfortunate reason, whether it's accident or injury in a war, like you just mentioned, they will continue to feel the presence of the limb that they once had, and sometimes even feel pain in that limb. And that really makes you question, what is it that you're perceiving? Because if you don't have the limb now, and there is objective proof that the limb is not there because obviously it was amputated, but you still continue to feel it. So one explanation that neurologists have come up with for why you're perceiving that limb is because what you normally perceive is not the physical limb, but representations or maps or models of the body that the brain builds. If everything is working well, those maps or models should be completely matched up to the physical body that you have. And in certain situations, like when you have had an amputation, sometimes the maps don't reorganize and you continue to feel the limb because what you perceive is the map or the model in the brain. Now you can imagine the opposite situation where your physical body, you know, everything is functioning healthy, but for some reason, some aspect of the modeling that the brain is doing of the body and the maps it's built have not kept up. And you know, something goes wrong or something is awry a little bit. So you have this condition where you can have a perfectly functioning leg, but it feels like it's not yours. And that, in some sense, is the mirror image problem of phantom limbs.
Wow. And then that brings us to your subject, David, who I also mentioned briefly here, who actually took this to an extreme.
Yeah, and it does get desperate for people who are suffering from it. Again, it's important to kind of understand that that's what they feel inside, and that's how they talk about it. And we don't know how this this condition arises. We don't know its full neurological basis. We don't know how much of it is what triggers it. And these are all things to be studied. But the way they feel is that it debilitates them through their life. They just are driven to despair and sometimes will take the extreme step of actually amputating the limb that doesn't feel like theirs.
And David actually did that and then reported being, what, more at peace afterwards?
Yeah, I exchanged emails with him a few months after his amputation to check up on, how he was feeling. And yeah, he said he had no regrets. And he's not the only one. There are studies that have been done in Germany where, neuropsychologists have looked at a set of patients, and not just one case, but a whole set of BID patients who over the years have gone through such surgeries and to see if they had any regrets and how they felt afterwards. And by and large, that is what they say, that they feel more complete paradoxically after having lost a part of their body. They feel more complete.
So a doctor did this for him, obviously. And the doctor understood why he was being asked to do this and that it was...
Yeah, I mean, I talked to the doctor.
He was...
It was kind of what can be called off the books. They had to do some level of subterfuge. But I talked to the doctor, and he researched the condition, and his position was that, look, I am a doctor. I have taken, an oath to do no harm, and I feel like these people are really suffering. This is up for debate. If you will find an equal, if not greater, number of doctors who are going to disagree with this. He was convinced that he's doing the right thing by his patients.
I have a question for you on an earlier topic, the doppelganger effect. Sue writes in, how does the doppelganger effect relate to the fact that we often form memories of ourselves in which we watch ourselves in a sort of third person experiencing an event, say?
That's a very, very nice question because, one of the things that, we were talking of doppelganger or even the out-of-body experience where you are outside looking at your own body, right? Yeah. And if you argue that, it's all happening in your brain, then why does it feel like I'm outside looking in? And actually, when you think about how the brain is functioning. Memories tell you a little bit about, you know, they give you a clue about how this might happen. We already have the ability to perceive our own, some aspects of our life from the outside, and memories are a very good example. Like if you experienced being on the beach, when you're experiencing the actual event, when you're at the beach, you're sort of in body. You're experiencing it from within your body. But when you try to recollect it, you'll most likely than not have the impression of watching yourself on the beach rather than from within the body.
Right,
it will be a third-person perspective. But it's, again, happening in your brain. So obviously there are mechanisms within the brain that allow us to have not a first-person perspective but a third-person perspective on things that are happening to us. And it's sort of that mechanism that might be getting tapped into when you're having an out-of-body experience.
So, Anil, I want you to help me with this then. This is not something that I think affects my sense of self necessarily, but maybe déjà vu, all right? The experience of déjà vu, of having already seen and heard a scene from your life. It can just be fleeting. It's very momentary. I recently had a stunning experience of déjà vu where I was sitting at a kitchen counter talking to two relatives. And I was so moved by the fact that this had already happened, the words had already been spoken, the clothes, everything was exactly the same. And I almost felt like I was sitting beside myself watching a scene unfold that had already unfolded before. And I know there are people in our audience listening now who have had déjà vu experiences, what we call déjà vu experiences. And I'm just eager to ask you this question, if you have any thoughts about what's happening there.
I didn't research déjà vu
for
my book. But, it comes down to this idea that a lot of things that we feel about ourselves, for instance, if you did something right now, if you picked up a bottle that's in front of you, you would have a sensation that I did it, right? Mm-hmm. And it turns out that that feeling of being an agent of some action is something that is something that the brain has to construct moment by moment for every action that you do.
Right.
And so feelings of déjà vu could be related to the fact that some process that makes in the brain that makes it seem like it's happening now is kind of disrupted, and there are issues to do with timing that are going on in the brain. And it's not directly related to the sense of self, so I didn't dig into it. But I'm sure it will shed light on the sense of self, the temporal aspects of the sense of self, if one digs into it. It's possibly also got something to do with the fact that the brain is constantly predicting what might happen next and anticipating what you might experience and comparing what actually happens with what it predicts. And something about this process, might be that you're perceiving the prediction before it has actually happened.
Right.
And then, you know, things happen, and somehow that then obviously will feel like, oh, this has already happened. And I'm speculating here, but
of course
there
you are. Yeah, I asked you to. I appreciate you doing that. Just to indulge me on this, actually our discussion of doppelganger effect got me to think about this stunning recent experience of déjà vu, because I felt for a moment like I was outside of the picture in which I was a member, a participant. You know, it was very strange. Anyway, thank you, Anil. We're going to take another break here. Anil Anathswamy, author of The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. We'll be right back. A short break. We have a lot more to talk about. And if you have a question, please give us a ring. Welcome back to Midday and our conversation with Anil Anathswamy. The Man Who Wasn't There is the name of his book, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. And I think we're going to talk about ecstatic epilepsy here, and I just wanted to quote from the book. I believe that you find this the most captivating condition to talk about and to study. or at least, because I'll just read it here. It says, because it leads to this paradoxical state where individuals have heightened self-awareness of their body and surroundings and yet feel that certain boundaries have dissolved, giving them a feeling of unity with something larger than themselves. Their sense of time slows down. A second seems to last much, much longer. They report feelings of bliss and well-being. Ecstatic epilepsy. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Anil.
Well, you've said it beautifully.
Yeah, you said it beautifully in your book. I was just quoting you. But what is this? Where does this come from?
So it's a seizure. It's an epileptic seizure. It's what's called a focal seizure, which means it's happening in a small part of the brain, and it doesn't overwhelm the entire cortex, so that you're not knocked unconscious as you would if you had a grand mal seizure. Hmm. And unlike other kinds of seizures, this actually is something that is very pleasant. And, people do report all those things that you just said, the intense physical and mental well-being, the slowing down of time, a sense of certitude about everything around them. They feel like, oh, things are just as they should be, and they almost ascribe a certain divinity to, their environment. They perceive their own bodily self and the sensations, of sights and sounds very intensely. But what to me is the most curious aspect of this is their feeling that they are one with something larger. So obviously some part of the self-non-self boundary has dissolved, has disappeared, and that somehow seems to give them this feeling that they are connected with the universe or whatever. I mean, the people will give you different ways of explanations for how it feels, but in a sense, some connection with a larger entity. And that is, when you dig into it to try and understand what might be happening, it's really very interesting. And what might be happening is that the seizure is really increasing the activity in the part of the brain that is normally responsible for creating your sense of the bodily self. This perception that you and I have of being in a body and feeling all the sensations, that are impinging on the body, whether it's light or sound, all those things, or the sense of touch on the skin. We normally have all of that, but we also have the other aspect of ourselves that's constantly going on in our heads, which is the narrative, the story that we are. And when we can't separate that out in any instant of our being, we are all those things at the same time. But during the seizure, it seems like what's happening is the bodily self part, just being here and now, has gotten heightened. It's like all the brain's resources are going into that. And what might be happening is that the narrative part, the storytelling, this constant back and forth in our heads into the past, into the future, that seems to be going away.
Hmm.
And maybe when that kind of drops out of the picture for that moment of the seizure, there's this feeling of oneness. That's kind of at least, one way of explaining what might be happening.
And I'm assuming we haven't talked about technological advances in terms of medical research here, and neuroimaging, for instance. Is that helping understand this?
In the case of ecstatic epilepsy, very much so, because I think until recently we didn't quite know exactly where the seizures were happening. It was just thought to be somewhere in the temporal lobe, which is on the sides. But it's been traced now through some high-resolution neuroimaging to something called the insular cortex, which is slightly deeper in the brain. And also there was one patient recently, I think it's about a year and a half ago, where she was being sort of treated for drug-resistant epilepsy because her epilepsy would eventually knock her unconscious. But she would have these ecstatic auras just before she would become unconscious. So there was something about her seizure that was also ecstatic. And it was not being, they could not treat her with drugs, so they had to do surgery. They had electrodes implanted in her brain to figure out where this seizure was beginning. And usually what neurosurgeons do when they have electrodes in the brain is they stimulate. They use the same electrodes not just to record, but actually to stimulate the brain to see what happens. And in her case, when they stimulated the insula, she immediately would have this ecstatic experience. And you stop the simulation and it would go away. So, they were able to pinpoint the region of the brain that might be responsible, or at least we have to be careful here. We have to say things, you know, we have to say, the best way to say this is that activity in the insula is correlated with the ecstatic experience.
After looking at all this, Anil, I'm curious to ask you this question in the time we have remaining together in this hour. I usually ask for the takeaway, maybe, but I guess I wonder if you were able to find scientifically where in the brain the notion of the self is hidden. Where do you think it is after all this? Or is that a question we should leave to the philosophers?
No, I mean, it's not a question to be left to the philosophers. It's a very neuroscientific question to ask, and the answer is there is no one place in the brain that is responsible for the self, just like the self is no one thing. I think that is the other important part, is that depending on how you're thinking about the self, it can be the narrative self, it can be the bodily self, it can be the social self, it can be the spiritual self. And there is no one place. It's like everything in the brain is working hard all the time to create the sense of who we are. And it's not just the brain. It is the body in conjunction with the brain. And I think that if there is one takeaway message that I have, is it would be that there is no one place in the brain, and don't ignore the body, because the body is very, very crucial. Everything that we are is underpinned by the bodily self. Disturbances to the body and disturbances to the sense of one's own bodily self can lead to all sorts of other disturbances of the cognitive narrative aspects of the self.
Mm. I guess it's one of the reasons why Alzheimer's is so frightening to people. The idea of losing that narrative that you've built your whole life, all those memories, who you are, the sense of self dissolving away.
Very much so. It is a very frightening condition. I mean, frightening to watch someone suffering from it, frightening to think that you might, you know, get it. And it's...
But it's ultimately who you are, your sense of existence, your sense of who you are.
Yeah, no, very much so. I think, you know, in terms of the functional selves that we are in society, the stories are the strongest aspect of what we are. And, you know, yes, it's underpinned by the body, and yes, it's underpinned by the sense of being a body. But really, you know, the stories are finally what make us who we are as we function in the society. And when that goes away, you know, our social interactions, our relationships, our ability to just be a person, that dissolves, and that's very frightening.
One last thing, and we only have about a minute left or so. You mentioned and described ecstatic epilepsy. I mean, if you could wish any of these conditions on yourself just to try it, do you think that would be it?
That would be the only one within the book that has any pleasant overtones. And you know, people probably experience this when they take psychedelic substances. I haven't personally, but, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of people who know exactly what we are talking about.
Anil, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show with us.
Dan, thank you very much. Yeah. This has been a lovely conversation.
Yes, I agree. Thank you very much. Anil Anathswamy is former deputy news editor and a current consultant for New Scientist. He teaches science journalism. His earlier book was The Edge of Physics, voted Book of the Year in 2010 by Physics World. And now this book, The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. Dutton is the publisher. Again, thank you very much, Anil.
My pleasure.
And thank you, everybody. That's our midday for today. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back soon for our staff. Have a great afternoon. We'll see you again tomorrow.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Samantha Max, Beatrix Lockwood, and Max Bookdahl. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.